Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another PT Pearl. So grateful again to have you here with us. Today we are talking into pain. Probably a very common thing that a lot of us experience, yeah? Mm-hmm. So we're talking into acute versus chronic pain, what it means, when we experience both of them, and how we can start approaching them. What is the right practices? Do we ice and rest? Should we move? Should we feel pain when we move? All of these different things. We want to help clear up some of the confusion in the head around it.
Yeah, and we'll hear these different terms, acute pain and chronic pain, right? And again, just like everything else, people like to approach these like they're two specific separate things, but it's really a spectrum of having acute pain, having that onset of pain. And then if that persists and we continue to perpetuate or allow that pattern, it might develop into a chronic type pain. Mm-hmm. So they have specific time brackets where they say, okay, if it's 6 weeks or less, then we're in a state of acute pain. And then, you know, whatever, 6 weeks to 2 months, maybe it's subacute, or over 2 to 3 months, then it works into chronic pain. But again, this is just a process of pain developing and actually how we perceive pain in our body and neurologically or in our brain. Mm-hmm. So we're going to dive a little more into that.
Mm-hmm. And you said specifically, because we were kind of chatting about this before, obviously, you know, when we hear these big brackets of acute versus chronic, it's usually like acute pain, 0 to 3 months, chronic pain, 3 to 6 months and beyond, right? That's usually like broadly based. But even you like to define it down even deeper in terms of acute pain and when that happens.
Totally, because acute pain really is just that initial inflammatory state to something that might happen that causes this acute pain or trauma, or we just go out and run and overuse something on one day and then we're way inflamed. Mm-hmm. And so we have this acute inflammatory process that generally is like, oh yeah, now we have pain, now we have soreness. And for me, anytime we get past 8 to 10 days, which is kind of how long general inflammation or if an inflammatory process starts, it should wrap up by 8 to 10 days and we should have healed the tissue or the process in that area. If we allow that pain or that process to continue beyond the 8 to 10 days, we start developing patterns. And if this is a back injury or if this is a knee injury, it might make us walk slightly different, or a back injury, we might not want to bend down to pick things up, or we might be a little bit afraid to bend down and pick things up because of that pain that we had felt that time. So we start creating these fears of doing certain movements again. And that is the start of this process of how we create chronic pain patterns in our bodies.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, acute is like, you know, something just happened and it could be a traumatic injury. It could be you just got out of surgery and you have a lot of swelling. I know, like in gymnastics, I remember I was doing a tumbling thing and I landed short, meaning I didn't completely stand up. I landed on my feet, but my ankles really took the brunt of it. Yeah. I woke up the next day and I remember lifting my foot up and I could see my mirror across from my bed. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, what is that? And it looked like a golf ball was just like sitting, or bigger, way bigger than that. It looked like a softball was sitting on top of my ankle.
Not just a golf ball. We're talking watermelon.
I was just like, looking across in the mirror, like holding my leg, like, what is that? But that was that acute experience, that acute inflammation that happens a lot. We get that a lot in knee swelling. We get that, you know, in these different, where we can actually palpably see it, feel it, and we know that it's acutely injured in that moment.
Yeah. And so now that we've kind of just like defined, okay, the acute injury is the thing that happens right away. And that's when we start having acute pain. Like, how do we approach that then? You know, it's been pretty typical that the recommendation would be rice, right? Rest, ice, compress, and elevate, right? And that has been something that's been around for a long time. Hey, we'll rest it. We'll let that thing calm down. We'll put ice on it to get the inflammation out of there and heal it. We'll compress it to get that swelling out. and elevate to get things to go back to the heart. But we're starting to realize that in that acute stage, we might need to do a little more.
Well, and we're realizing that inflammation, especially in acute stages, is not bad. That is your body's natural response. So why are we trying to drive out our body's natural ability to heal itself?
Yeah.
We need this inflammatory process to happen. We need these initial bouts of swelling at the area to actually be creating change within the tissue so that we start to heal. So rather than just running and icing it or resting it, we need to start changing the way that we approach it.
Yeah. So generally, our first recommendation would be change the thing that brought about that initial inflammation in the first place. You know, was it a big new workout that you did that you may not have been ready for? Did you start a new training program in the last few weeks? Did you have any sort of surgery or traumatic injury that happened recently? And so what was that initial stimulus that caused that acute pain to come on, and can that easily be removed, mm-hmm. right? And then the next thing is, how do we start to direct that inflammation process rather than letting it do what it wants? How can we take advantage of the healing that's happening there?
Mm-hmm. So that means that I'm not going to completely just elevate, rest, and forget about it.
Do nothing.
But I'm actually, okay, maybe I don't feel comfortable walking on it, but I'm going to start seeing how my ankle feels to just start moving back and forth a little bit. Can I even get some movement in there? Can I start pumping it? Then can I start putting a little bit more pressure? Can I use a band and start moving it up and down? You know, how can I work with this inflammatory process to guide my body back into a movement that I want to create? And that's where we modify, we back off, but we don't stop. And I think that's what we're learning more and more really helps to support the body in true healing.
And again, that is always dependent on who you are, where you're at, and what kind of acute pain we're dealing with, mm-hmm. right? Somebody might only be able to pump their ankle around in circles or do the alphabet with their ankle, and that's plenty,
mm-hmm.
because more than that would cause that inflammation to worsen.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the inflammatory process is great, but say we go and do something and the next morning we feel more inflammation or it feels more swollen. That was probably too much.
Yeah.
And if we again perpetuate that inflammation time after time after time, then our body gets a little confused and doesn't know if it's good and we should be healing that way or if it's causing more damage. So again, that comfortable active range of motion just to start teaching those fibers that may have been damaged or hurt, hey, this is how we heal back so that the movement that we have once we're healed is what we're supposed to have there.
Exactly. And then when it starts moving along the continuum and it's getting into this chronic stage, so say you've had back pain for mm-hmm. over 6 weeks now. Say you've been walking on a faulty ankle for over 6 weeks, shoulder pain for over 6 weeks, whatever it may be, or 12 weeks or three, you know, months of this now, 6 months we're getting up to. And it is continuing. I've backed up. I backed off the things that I'm supposed to be not doing that were aggravating it. I've modified, you know, whatever it may be. And yet you're still having pain. Why is that happening? What should we be doing? Should we still be icing? Should we be heating? Should we be doing ice and heat? Should we be, you know, should I be wrapping it? Should I still be holding it tight? What should I be doing that is correct? And that's where we're going to kind of go into now.
Yeah, because when we have chronic pain, again, we've generally started to train other processes in our body that we might not be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Because pain is like the great equalizer in life, and it's one of the greatest motivators. And when we have pain during the day, it motivates us to not do certain things, right?
Yeah.
Even if we're not paying attention to it. Hey, when I have pain, when I go to sit down on the toilet, maybe I'm going to do something slightly different and I'm going to avoid squatting straight down like I normally do. And I'm going to kind of turn to my side and use one hand on the seat and then sit down, right? We start developing these patterns. Like I start to get back pain more even when I think about sitting on a toilet, or I see a box and I think about going down to pick it up and then my back pain starts hurting more. That's when the issue with the pain starts becoming more the beliefs,
yes.
more the conditioning that we've kind of preached into our system over that 6 weeks to 6 months or more of having that pain.
And that's where we get to start developing a new relationship with that pain in order to start to heal along this journey of chronic pain. And understand, everyone in the world has pain. Like literally, I'm not sure you're going to find someone, maybe they're highly, highly enlightened and they just have this new relationship with it. But, and it's just essentially where we want to get to, because to be honest, we're going to experience pain and it is a normal part of our relationship in life, with our relationship with our body. And it allows us to understand what we need to start focusing on. I yawn when I know that I need to get more sleep and I'm probably a little bit more tired. My stomach grumbles when I know that I probably haven't, maybe I'm not drinking enough water or eating enough food or whatever. I'm neglecting something. And so when pain is showing up in the body, it's just like, hey, you're not moving me as much, or you're neglecting something. Am I neglecting my stretching routines? Am I neglecting my strength routines? Am I only doing yoga because I'm afraid to strength train? We don't want to just be doing one thing, okay? And so having this new relationship with pain, that tells me it's just my alarm system. It's good. It alerts me when I need to start diving in and I'm not paying attention to something. Also, pain, when something else can be happening that's a little deeper, so it's organ related, it's disease related, and it's deeper into the body, when we start feeling it on the outside, that's our alarm system again for something could be happening more internally. And so pain is good. It's our friend. And especially when it's tissue related, it means that there's healing, or there could be healing that is happening. And it is necessary, a part of the journey, in order for us to start getting back to our goals.
Yeah. And that pain has developed there for a reason. And again, usually because of different patterns that we're starting to develop in that acute or that subacute stage of pain. And so when we get into these chronic stages, we actually start to heighten kind of the sensors that are perceiving things in that area. So let's just go to the back pain example. Mm-hmm. You know, say before we've ever had pain here, like our nerves rest at a certain level. Mm-hmm. You know, say that's 10. And they feel pain when we get to 20, right? So you hit your knee and it bumps you past that 20 range, right? Because you hit your knee pretty hard. When we've had chronic pain, our resting level comes up, instead of 10, we're resting at 18 or 19. And it takes very little. We think about a stressful conversation we had with a friend and it bumps us up above that 20. And then we feel that back pain. Again, we think about, oh, I need to walk downstairs and unload my car, the groceries from my car. We spike above that 20. So we start again. Any stress that adds load to that nervous system might bump us above that pain threshold and then make us experience that chronic pain, because, again, we've had a good 6 months now of training these systems to be ready to protect us against something that might make us perceive pain.
Mm-hmm. And then we just get, we build more beliefs. Well, that hurt. You say I was already in that heightened state of stress and all the other things were compounded upon it. And then I did the movement and it confirmed, like, see, I had pain, so I can't bend down. I can't lift that thing. I can't do this. I can't do that. We start to build upon these beliefs. Or I went to the doctor. They showed me an MRI. See, that's why. That's why I can't do this. This confirms my belief in my head of what was happening. And now that is true. That is right. Now my belief is that this thing I need to, I mean, there's so many different things that we start to then fall into these terminology from a lot of doctors, a lot of clinicians as well, in terms of physical therapists and chiropractors, who drill in this message of fear of things that we can't do anymore. We can't ride bikes anymore because I can't bend down. I can't bend down to even tie my shoes because I can't round my back.
Don't pick your kids up. Whatever it may be, like the things that doctors might start telling people, it really puts a lot of fear as to how they're going to live purposefully and, again, continues to perpetuate this problem. And so we, again, before these things, kind of tap into a little research or look into a few studies, and the things that it says are never related to the chronic pain or never directly correlated to this is why you have that chronic pain are, you know, weak neck muscles.
Brace yourself for this, right? Okay? Because this is going to be a big one that you've heard this all the time from your therapist. Maybe you've even heard it from my page, okay? So brace yourself, because this doesn't determine back pain. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, the things that don't cause back pain are anterior pelvic tilts, weak core muscles, weak neck muscles, the structure and how it looks on an image, right? So these different things aren't the things that are the cause of your back pain.
Yeah. So even like, oh, I have scoliosis. So do I. I don't have back pain. So, you know, even increased kyphosis in the thoracic spine or increased lumbar lordosis doesn't always predict that you have back pain. Yeah. Even not only anterior pelvic tilt, but posterior hip shifts. Can't determine that it's your back pain.
Torn rotator cuffs, you know, biceps tears, these types of things doesn't necessarily equate why we have the level of pain we have.
Trigger points.
Yeah.
Places where I touch you. Oh, that feels hot. That feels really sensitive. This is why you have pain. Nope.
The end result, but it's not why.
It cannot determine why. Okay. And so all of this to say, like, there's a doctor out there who I've taken a course from. I really like him, Dr. Greg Lehman. And he talks a lot about what this pain science really means within the body. And you guys, if you're experiencing chronic pain, places to go, I would say Explain Pain is a great one. Resources and articles from Greg Lehman, are great to read and refer to.
Is it Pain Explained? Pain Explained.
Pain Explained.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay. One from Soros, I believe, which was on the back. I can't remember that one, but we'll link it in the show notes of some of these resources that you can start going to, because it's not to say pain is all in your brain. No, it's rethinking our movement patterns of how we can start to reteach the tissue and the nervous system of how they play together. So it's not at all like, oh, this is, you're making it up. It's in your brain. If someone is telling you that,
no,
it's not right.
Or if that's what you're thinking, I mean, ask some questions, because again, we talk about it as a process of training these different neurologic processes in the brain. And if you imagine something as a cup or a bucket, right? We have certain amounts of things that fill this bucket. And over time, we're just going to start overflowing because the bucket gets filled up with things like stress, worry, belief, you know, repetitive motions and postures, or what we feel during those motions and postures. And those are the kinds of things that fill up this cup of chronic pain.
Yeah.
And then it really easily starts overflowing. So to start emptying that cup, we start to address those things.
Well, we have to address everything that could fill up the cup. Are you getting enough sleep? Are you eating the most nutritious foods? Or are you eating more? Are you not getting as much nutrition within your diet? Are you drinking enough water? Are you in an environment of constant stress, meaning you go home, you have kids screaming, you go to work, you have a boss screaming, you go, like, your relationship is in turmoil, all these things. Any one of these things, it does not have to be tissue damage. Again, it's not structural. It's not tissue damage. It's not just biomechanics. Can biomechanics play a role into loading the body when we're putting on load? 100%. We still want to understand how we can improve our efficiency within our body.
Yeah, I think there was something Greg Lehman said, like, just because whatever we think that neurologic processes might be more active during chronic pain, it doesn't make physics not exist. So if you put your joint in a certain position and load it really, really, really heavily, you might injure yourself.
Yeah.
That's not what we're saying.
But we have to look at all of these things all together. It's not one or the other. Okay. Mm-hmm. And once one of them starts to overspill, that's when we start to amplify this experience of pain within our body. And our body is really good at saying, oh, this is where you felt the pain. I'm going to go right back there because that's what I know. So again, like Dom said in the beginning, that stressor hits. I mean, good example I can use is I at times get shoulder blade, my right shoulder blade kind of flares up. This is where I also have decreased range of motion on my right side, scoliosis. I can blame it on a lot of things. But overall, when I know I'm in a heightened moment or position or experience of stress, my right shoulder blade goes up. I got in a car accident. Everyone was fine, but it was my fault. And I ran into someone and immediately my right shoulder blade like flared up. Now, we were only on the street. Luckily, we weren't going very fast at all. Like, everyone was fine. But my right shoulder blade flared up and I guarantee like the thing didn't even come up. What is that?
Airbag.
The airbag didn't even come out and hit me. So it wasn't like a huge car accident. You know, did I get whiplash? Maybe. But it was more so that I was in the process of learning all these things too. And when I got into the car accident and I felt my right shoulder blade, I said, oh my God, how cool. My right shoulder blade, I can feel it. And I got excited about the experience because I knew that I was in stress. And the moment, let me tell you again, the moment that I acknowledged that my shoulder blade was having that experience of pain because I got into a car accident out of stress of the situation, it went away. Mm-hmm. It went away.
Yeah. It's amazing to see. I mean, I could bring up similar examples for myself, but when I have my chronic type pain, things come up or things that keep revisiting me, when I calm down and take a few breaths, it gets it to go away. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with me reposturing or whatever. Just take a few breaths, calm my system down, and my back pains go away as well. So these are things that work for us. So we're not just saying it as if we're, you know, clinicians telling people do this to deal with your chronic pain. We experience these things too.
But it's just to say, if you have moments of being able to change your beliefs, if you know, like, start journaling on the positive times, not saying every time I do this, I have back pain. You're playing into the belief that every time you do that, you're going to have back pain.
Yeah.
Now start saying, what are the mornings I wake up and I didn't notice back pain? Maybe you can say, oh, well, I was distracted. My kids came in and da-da-da. Well, that's okay. That's still a win. That's still a win. I don't care if it was a distraction. You didn't notice the pain. So start journaling on those experiences and you're going to start to see a pattern and a new belief of what is possible to achieve, whether it's lifting, whether it's running, whether it's cycling, whatever it is that you want to do, it is possible to get past this. Yes, continue to do all the exercises and learn about your body, continue to sleep and get good nutrition and get all these other things. Yes, we want all of that, but start to rewire your beliefs around what this pain means. And the only tools that can get you out of it is someone else fixing you or doing something. And, you know, there could be more to the system. And there was something else about working out with chronic pain.
Like, one of the studies that I looked at said that when we are dealing with people who have chronic pain, it's probably actually more beneficial to do the movements that give you some pain rather than doing movements that are pain-free. Again, because one of the biggest processes that needs to happen is re-educating that movements that give us pain aren't bad, because it's just that movement itself that's triggering our pain process. So retraining that movement and retraining our relationship with that movement and understanding that just doing it can help us desensitize it is the biggest part of the process. So that's called like remapping those movements so that we know, oh, we're safe. It just is painful because that's the thing that's always giving me pain.
Mm-hmm. And something that integrated kinetic neurology, a course that I took from some friends, they went over, you know, your brain develops what are called neurotags. And it's just places in the brain where, again, like just like my stressor, my shoulder blade is going to pop up in the pain area. My brain has developed a neurotag to understand when stress or that part of my cup overfills, or I don't have enough sleep, or I'm drinking more alcohol, or whatever it may be, that is the area that's going to feel pain because I have that neurotag. So I can retrain the neurotag by understanding it, first of all, by changing the relationship with it, by touching it. Even touching and breathing into it can start to change your relationship of what you're feeling, moving into it. And you can always modify movement. So if I want to do a deadlift again, how can I do it where I still kind of feel pain, but maybe I'm using a little bit of support, or I'm not going as heavy, or I'm modifying the exercise so it's still in the same pattern, but it looks a little bit different. And there's so many ways that we can do that. We break it down in our programs and the optimal body, and always just kind of teaching how to continue to move and be able to come back into this place in your body.
Absolutely.
All right, let's take a moment and talk about strong coffee. You know, we've mentioned this before. We have it all the time. And let me tell you, as a person who used to be like a little afraid of collagen and unsure of what it could really do because it's still so new, once I started actually using it myself, you could really then see the benefits. And the thing about strong coffee is that they have a complete collagen protein from grass-fed and grass-finished cows that really helps to support healthy joints, tendons, muscles. And on top of that, it's going to support hydrated skin, hair, joints, and just help you to be so strong and feel so good within your entire body. And of course, it tastes delicious. So go check it out. The link is in the show notes. So just go ahead and go into the show notes, click the link, use code OPTIMAL15 at checkout to get 15% off your first order and try out Strong Coffee.
Coming up next, we have a physical therapist, Matt Erb, who we're so excited to be able to share with you. He is a senior faculty clinical supervisor and clinical lead for the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, an instructor for Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, and Matt has a clinical practice with Simmons Physical Therapy in Tucson, Arizona, and is the founder of Embody Your Mind, focused on writing, teaching, and consulting with different integrative medical practices. Jen and I are just so excited to share the information that he brings with you, and stick around because about midway through his interview, he takes us through this amazing experiential exercise that will help you dive deeper into your body and understand the choices you make and how it influences your physiology. So let's dive in.
All right. Welcoming to the podcast, we have Matt Erb here, another fellow physical therapist, which I love having other physical therapists on here to continue to preach this message and honestly get something different into the body that our listeners probably haven't heard before. So Matt, if you could just walk us through your journey just briefly in terms of what inspired you to even become a physical therapist and how has it kind of led you down the road to being the physical therapist you are today?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I actually did my undergraduate in biology and I then started out in veterinary school and had a little bit of a early sort of internal crisis. Is this what I want to do or not? And had a friend who had already been in a PT program and said, I think you'd really like this. And so I took a leave of absence from veterinary school and applied and got in. And within the first 2 weeks of the program, I knew that that was the route I was headed. And so wrote the veterinary school back and said, I'm not going to be returning. And didn't realize at the time that that, you know, was really rooted in a desire for connection, human connection and relationship. And also didn't realize at the time that the extent to which physical therapy was reduced. It was sort of a reduction and didn't train me adequately into all of the sort of whole person lens and care. And that's what launched my journey into mind-body integration and other facets of whole person care.
Yeah, so I kind of love where you, I think when we initially chatted, you told us about where you initially started at, in your career, and how you spent a little bit of time in this traditional system, and then wanted to develop something different that allowed you to kind of address the person. So could you talk to us about where you started initially and how that formed the foundation for your career, and then why and what made you make that leap into creating what you've created now?
Okay, so I think what I would start with and say that, I did spend a long time, almost 16 years in a large-scale healthcare system, traditional biomedical system, and that proved to be, you know, very valuable. The whole time was a valuable training ground for the development of my work, and that included the early stages of training in mind-body medicine, some of the integrative care concepts. And I think that we have a tendency, there's certainly challenges found in our healthcare system that run all the way upstream to the headwaters in policy, organizational, systemic structure. And there's also a tendency for us to get into either or, good, bad. And so I see my time there as exceptionally valuable in terms of the early training ground for the formation of what I'm doing now. It happened to be that a shift because of my wife's work led me out of that system and into a smaller private practice. And I do think that that opened up even more flexibility for me to continue to develop and build the work that I'm doing now. But I certainly value both and recognize there's many challenges in the healthcare system that we have to learn to navigate. The irony of that is that when we learn to apply whole person care principles to ourselves, it helps us develop the creativity, the adaptability and the flexibility that's needed to navigate any setting, whether it's a private practice, whether it's a labeled as integrative or biomedical, or a combination of both, that there are certain principles that we can embody ourselves that help us see that where we are, we're able to serve and contribute to the transformation, the ongoing transformation of our healthcare system towards towards better quality, person-centered care.
And there's things to learn in every single setting. So I love that you know, you're not just one or another. You're how can we continue to evolve and continue to get better as a total. So I really appreciate your approach in that as well. Now, we're kind of dancing around it. Can you just kind of say what it is, the type of physical therapy that you do, that you label it today, and what that even means? Like, what is this type of physical therapy? Could people go out and find it? Or is it something that's very unique to you and your practice?
Yeah, so I guess I'd start by saying, like most things, this is a very complex or complicated question, but I do use the term integrative. My hope is that that term eventually would not be needed. All labels and terms will carry associations. They may carry bias. They may carry emotional charges, depending upon who you're talking to. In the United States, integrative medicine in the world of physicians has become a more solid, grounded, evidence-based model of care, and it's really becoming both and. It's not presented as either or. It's either biomedical, and we're bashing biomedical. Some people tend to see integrative care as sort of, you know, alternative, unfounded, non-science-based. But the IM, integrative medicine movement in the United States, is very careful to keep it focused on the available research and to contribute to the redistribution of research funding. If there's less research, it's not always because it's not viable, you know, it's not validated, but it's because there's a lack of funds going to research integrative care. That may not be true in all areas, but I prefer the word integrative because it reflects integral. And that means rejoining parts. Science necessarily breaks things down into parts, and that's in many ways necessary for the study of our experience. Science does that purposely, but when we work with the whole person, we need to rejoin the parts in many ways, and that's where I think that we fall short in our training. We're not offering as much transdisciplinary training as is needed to really equip therapists to comfortably and safely address a whole person care.
Yeah, and I love how you kind of talk about rejoining the parts. I mean, I always talk about the way we do research as isolating or looking at one specific portion of a car and just thinking that we can change parts out like that. But humans don't operate that way. And it's really hard to study a person as a whole and have control of all those variables. So what I want to kind of chat about is, for you, when somebody comes in, what does an integrative PT session look like? Is there a standard or a way that you work through that session? And if somebody's searching for an integrative PT, are they able to find that?
I'll start with the last part of the question. There is a growing number of rehab therapists, PTs, OTs, that are addressing whole person care, that are attempting to increase their capacity to do so. Much of it falls under the label of biopsychosocial. We're in the development of a project right now. We're writing about this, and biopsychosocial is a wonderful concept and model. However, it's often seen as three separate things. Just the nature of the way that that's structured. Biopsychosocial is three compartmentalized things. That, for example, suggests that psychosocial is not biological. It's not represented by biological underpinnings. And so the idea of integral is to see the whole and to not just see those things as three separate things. And then the way that we're defining it, we're adding in things like living systems theory and principles of emergence, process orientation. Now, to go back to the first part of the question, what it looks like, I see integrative care and this is true for biopsychosocial care and even biomedical care, which is why eventually I'd hope that the labels fall apart, as being fundamentally relational. We need to devote ourselves to understanding the nature of relationships, to seeing the hidden determinants that may be informing people's experience, to provide support to them. So in an integrative care session for me, it's spending a valuing a significant amount of time in sharing, in talking, in gathering a fuller picture, but not making any assumptions as to which parts of that picture. If I ask someone about their history, if I ask someone about history of accidents, injuries, or trauma, there's their mental health history, their upbringing, because we know that early life experiences, such as adverse stress exposure, can carry profound influence on our health later on. And we need to be equipped to address that. So my initial session is more focused on subjectivity, seeking to really understand the person's experience, their needs, their preferences, their beliefs, because reinforcing that over rushing into, I got to fix this, I've got to determine with some degree of certainty the causality here, that A causes B. It's a shift away from that, and it's more focus on the person and tell me what this is like. And I think I begin repeating myself now, so I'll just stop with that and see if that leads into another.
No, I 100% appreciate it. It's actually why I shifted away from the traditional clinic myself as well. I realized there's not enough time to actually connect here. Like, even if I get an hour for a patient for an evaluation, you're still expecting me to get their home exercise program together, as well as actually get to know them as a human and make them feel comfortable in the setting of a clinic. So my question is, how do you convince people, like, hey, for this first part, maybe for the first few sessions, we're just going to talk. I'm going to get to know you. Because when people think physical therapy, chiropractic, they are thinking, you are going to fix me. You are going to tell me something that no one else has told me yet, and you are going to fix me. So how do you get people to start to think differently in a session when they're coming to you?
Yeah, this is a really important question, because we have a cultural dynamic that is rooted in fixer, fixee. And both we as healthcare professionals fall into it, assuming that it's my job to fix, and the public often, in an unconscious, this is often implicit, it's unconscious, comes in with an expectation that someone is going to fix this. Someone's going to have a nice packaged answer to this problem, and that if I do X, Y, or Z, the truth is, as we all know, that often isn't the case. There is a complexity that informs it. And so, you know, in my practice, it starts out of the gates with the referral base, letting people know that this is whole person care. It's mind body integrated care, actually naming these things so that people begin to form some understanding of it. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm not necessarily going to offer people experiments and experiences, things to try, but I present them as, this isn't necessarily something that's going to fix X, Y, or Z, but I believe at the bare minimum, it might help improve your quality of life. It may improve your stress response in relationship to this problem. So an example would be, I often test people's heart rate variability as part of my evaluation, because it's an indicator of autonomic nervous system function. And when I do that, I'll often introduce people to breath awareness, just becoming aware of how their breath reflects their physiological state, and how something as simple as subtle shifts in one's breathing pattern can alter your overall physiological state. But I convey the message that this isn't, I try to help people value why they would want to do this independent of an attachment to an outcome, which is where we start to break down that expectation that the person has to come in. So there's a lot of education. There's a lot of naming these dynamics, calling them out.
Yeah, that's great. And I love the way that you give someone something so that they can then see that response. But again, like you said, not be attached to the end outcome, you know, understanding that something different gets to be addressed first. And that is, you know, more that, again, root cause approach. You mentioned just kind of introducing someone to breath and helping them understand how that might affect their physiology. So for listeners listening right now, is there anything that you could tell them to try themselves that they could explore and maybe feel something different or maybe have a little more awareness within their own bodies right now as they're listening?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea, and I can offer just a short experiential. So for the listeners, if you're in a place where it's appropriate or safe to do so, certainly not if you're driving, but if you're in a place where it's appropriate to close your eyes, what I invite is to consider that as a symbol of orienting your attention inward as well as downward. That we spend much of our day in the mental realm, the cognitive realm, and thought. And we don't always see how that thought or thinking processes are reflected in the body. So just invite people to gather up that attention into this inward and downward attention and see what you discover. See where your attention lands. You might discover places that are sore or tense or tight, holding, constricting, patterns in the body. If so, you might allow that awareness to present an opportunity for softening. Sometimes we discover that we're in a state of urgency because we have our to-do list in our mind, and we might even reflect to ourselves, now is not an emergency, as a reminder to our nervous system that it's possible to temper the speed, the urgency that we might be encountering. And as you do this, you become aware of the breath. You don't necessarily seek to rush into a fix it. I got to fix it. Because awareness is a catalyst into itself. So when you reflect your attention, I love the old Chinese saying that where your mind goes, qi flows. Well, at a neuroscientific level, the direction of conscious attention is increasing connectivity between regions of the brain and other aspects of your physiological state. So you notice your breath and see how it might shift naturally. Certainly, after you do that, you do have a choice. The breath is a powerful entry point. The conscious manipulation of the breath is one way in which we can have a positive impact on the base physiological state, our nervous system, our autonomics. It doesn't fix everything to do this, but it's a necessary skill for resilience, for mature coping. You could see it as consciously choosing to regulate your breath helps you develop comfort with discomfort, because it's not intended to necessarily fix or make the discomfort go away. And then you do have a choice to influence it. You might see if softening your breath, smoothing it out, perhaps deepening it, if that feels right for you. I don't rush to just say deep breathing. I let that be a choice. And longer, too, as some of the research has shown that gradually lengthening the exhales, sometimes as much as twice as long as our inhale, can have a powerful influence on the vagus nerve, for example. So you can try that on for another few breaths, and then we'll return our attention back to the discussion.
That was so beautiful. Dom and I are over here like doing it ourselves. And I love the way that you just, you tucked it in from both, you know, going into Chinese medicine, but then also bringing it back to neuroscience. So no matter where you are on the spectrum, it's for everyone. And it was truly integrative. So anyone can kind of start to try that on. There's no one way. There's no one perfect fix. And you continue to remind people of that. And even as breathwork becomes more popular in today's age, I think there is this concept of, well, what kind of breath and how long do I do it for and what does it look like? And there's all, people want these strict regulations. People want to be told exactly what to do. So when you're guiding people back into their own awareness, how do you pull them out of this, well, how long? And how often? And, you know, these strict rules that they want to be given. How do you allow them to really find this awareness and lead into the acceptance piece?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I would start by saying I try my best to be aware of the gap between where people are at and what might be ideal. So bridging realism and idealism. I often try to meet people where they are. So if I get someone who has a very intellectual orientation, thrives on precision, prescription, order, then I'm more apt to meet them at that level, at least out of the gates, and say, you know, that remember an old study, this is 25, 30 years ago by Norm Shealy, who was a neurosurgeon in Missouri. And it was looking at gravity-centered breathing, where they got people laying on their back with their feet up and diaphragmatic breathing. And I don't remember the exact amount, but I remember that it showed that 15 to 20 minutes of conscious breathing in this way had hours of impact on the state of the autonomic nervous system. So I might say to someone, if you really are the type of person that responds well to structure and sort of, I don't like the word, but discipline, then maybe you'd benefit from setting a timer and starting at 10 or 15 or even 20 minutes of consciously doing this practice. For others, that would be highly aversive. So I try to use almost a motivational interviewing approach to find, if you were going to work with this, first identify why you want to do it. How does this connect up to your values? And then two, what is the commitment you want to make? If you're 80% certain that you could follow through with such and such over the next week or 2 weeks, what would that be? So that it's trying to help them to determine how do they want to use it. So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. Jen and I both found a lot of our own journey and how we change that with breath. And even when you're doing that exercise, I'm getting my own, you know, body chills. Because when you can talk someone through that themselves and make it a choice and make all the things that they experience that the result of a choice they made, it can be just super empowering. And that's where I've noticed switches in people that I work with saying like, oh gosh, you know, I can make these choices and feel a change. And so that, again, just super powerful and empowering. A little bit earlier, you had mentioned something about trauma and trauma in the body. And I just want you to speak a little bit to how that plays a role in people's journeys and rehab and how it can really impact someone's pain or symptoms.
If you look at some of the leading experts in the field of trauma, trauma studies and trauma science, and the titles of their books, The Body Bears the Burden, The Body Keeps the Score, The Body Never Lies, we understand that there is very much a distributed sort of form of memory in the integrated mind-brain-body sort of system that can be influencing the present. And I often will say to people, you know, the research has demonstrated that really every moment of prior experience carries potential influence on how our nervous systems, our brains and bodies are interacting with and responding in the present. And then I might lead into, you know, there's one of the top public health issues of our times is understanding that stress exposure early in life, which is in many ways ubiquitous. The stress is inherent in our world and we all encounter it. Even things like, you know, I'll often share my own story and say, you know, my parents divorced when I was 10. And early on in life, my father had a drinking issue. And while he got sober, the research shows that living in these conditions can impact our health later. But the reason I'm bringing it up is not because we need to analyze that. I say, look back, but don't stare. We want to understand how the past may be influencing the present. And that actually helps us make choices about what actually will help us in the present. And so I use it sort of as a lead up to underscoring the relevance of mind-body medicine, for example. Mind-body skills in the research on them pretty universally says that they help develop psychophysiological resilience, that they help to undermine if the past has impacted us. Practicing these here and now helps us address that. So I'm not I'm helping create safety by not wanting people to think that, oh, well, suddenly I'm wanting to do a regressive analysis of your childhood. But I do want to acknowledge that the past carries influence, is found in the experience of the body in the present, or can be. And then it becomes self-selecting. I'll say, how do you feel about that? What does this topic bring up for you? And do you think it's possible that the past has any relevance in what you're experiencing now? Because that gives me a better feel as to whether it's an area to explore more or to back away from, because there's perhaps some disinterest or aversion in it.
This is so interesting. And I hope that it's starting to open people's mindset as to where, especially their chronic pains, could potentially be coming from. I know so often I work with clients, and even just starting to drop that awareness from the cognitive and back into the body and start with breath, people will all of a sudden start crying. And some people don't know why. Why am I crying? Where is this coming from? And just being able to have this piece of openness, acceptance, awareness of the body, and be able to work with someone that, you know, sees the whole person is so beautiful and so important. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing, the shift that you're hopefully continuing to go down, so that we have more therapists modeling what you're doing and reading the book that you're going to be putting out. But in this, where could people possibly start to find more information either about you or about integrative physical therapy?
Yeah, so I have a couple of resources. A lot of my early understanding of mind-body medicine came from taking professional CME training with the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, cmbm.org, out of Washington, D.C. I since went on to become a faculty member with them and do clinical work with them, clinical supervision and so on. So that's one resource. The CMBM model is built on small group work, but it's also a form that you can learn the core mind-body medicine, because that is translatable to individual work as well. I also have a website, embodyyourmind.com, has an overview of all of my work, teaching, consulting. Within that, I have a parallel to this textbook that we're developing called Integrative Rehabilitation Practice. Have developed an online CE course. It's integrativerehabpractice.com. That course is highly accessible. It's 45 hours of training. Right now it's, on a sliding fee scale. So the entry point for 45 hours of training is like, I think it's $399, but I'll let anyone register for it based on what they can pay. So it's pretty much sliding fee scale, because I want to get the word out and really support this shift so that we can improve quality of care towards the whole person model. So those would be the top three things you can look at.
I so much so appreciate that you are pushing this in a way to make it accessible to both the provider and the individual, the client out there, searching and seeking for something different, whether they know it or don't. Because Jen and I have had mentors of our own that are peers of yours in this journey, people that you probably know of and don't know of, that have really inspired us to do things slightly differently. And so if you're out there, either a person or a clinician of any sort, I would encourage and urge you to look into these things if you've ever been looking for something differently. And we will link all those things you just mentioned up in the bio, and we are so excited to get these things out to more people to also hopefully be a part of this continued shift in how we approach medicine, about how we approach the human body, and how we approach people. So thank you so much for coming on with us today. This was super enlightening to us, and hopefully to a lot of our audience out there, and hopefully we will continue to chat with you into the future.
Great. I appreciate the time to chat with you both and appreciate the work you're doing. And just want to say that in our early communication, I think it was Jen used the word multidirectional. And I really like that, because it reflects that we need to be trained to go in multiple directions. Even in mind-body, it occurs on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And so that really is another word that helps convey or points the way, and that eventually these labels may not be needed as we all move towards whole person capacity. So thank you for your work and for this time together.
Thank you so much, Matt. We'll chat soon.
Thank you so much for listening to us on the Optimal Body Podcast, where we're going to continue to bring you the PT pearls and guests that will help you find your optimal body. Now, head over to wherever you listen to this and leave us an honest review, and head to docgenfit.com/podcast, where you can find all the show notes.
Don't forget that we're going to give away a free month to someone who subscribes, leaves us an awesome review, and lets us know what they want to review on the next PT Pearl. So we'll be choosing that once a week to get into a free month of the Optimal Body membership.